This class, Parshas Vayishlach, is dedicated in memory of Blima Pesel Bas Esther and my father, Harav Gershom ben Harav ben Siam. So we're going to get right into it, and Ben just mentioned that first Rashi, Vayishlach. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim. Yaakov sent messengers, and it's interesting that the Torah chooses to use this word, Malachim, the same word that is used for angels. It can be used for just messengers, but it chooses it. It could say shlichim, which just means a messenger, but it uses the word malachim, angels. And Rashi points out to us, malachim mamash, actual angels. It wasn't just messengers. He didn't just get together some people and say, okay, hey, go to Esav. You know, when you're preparing to battle with someone as evil as Esav, you really have to have the elite forces. And so that's what he had. And we'll talk a little bit later about how he prepared them for three different things, how he had a three-pronged plan. And for some of you who haven't been here before, if you go back, I know other years we also spoke about the three-pronged plan in detail, I believe. But let's first address this question of he sent actual angels. What is that about? Now, Rashi says, Malachim Mamash, actual angels. And we'll see that Hasidic interpretation goes even deeper to what does it mean, actual angels. But before that, I want to relate, you know, every Jewish story with a king, right? Parable with a king. So there was a great and wise king who had a beautiful big empire, but he felt that he knew that there was an area in his empire, a far-flung area, where the people were uncivilized, where they were barbaric, where they were not learned, they were not cultured, they were not tamed, they were just barbaric. And he knew about this part of his empire that was in a far-flung area, and he said, the best person to go and help me to elevate this area of mine, because I want my kingdom to be an elevated kingdom. I want it to be a kingdom of good people, cultured people, people who act nicely to each other, who spread goodness and kindness. I am going to send my best man to go and help take care of this problem. And the best man, in his case, was his son, his wise son and his talented son. And so he said to his son, I'm sending you on a mission. It's a very important, but it's also a dangerous mission. I need you to go to this far-flung area in my kingdom, and I need you to go and work on elevating that area of people, the barbaric civilization that has sort of evolved out there, and I need you to help to uplift these people, to elevate them, and to make it into a much better world in that corner of my kingdom. And the wise, talented son, he looked at his father and he says, Father, I'm ready to do what you ask, but how am I going to succeed in that mission? It's dangerous. How do I know that I won't get affected from that area? Because I'm one person. I'm going alone. How on earth am I going to, and you're here. You, who are the biggest influence in my life, the greatest influence in my life, how am I going to go to that area and not be affected? And so the king says, this is the plan. You're going to go, and you're going to take your body there, and even your mind, and even your heart, because you're going to need it in order to succeed. But your soul, you're going to leave here. How can that be? Can you be in two places at once? In Yiddish, there's an expression, Mekenesh Tansen of Tzvei Chasenes. I won't continue the end of that sentence sometimes, but you can't dance at two weddings with the same feet. But the truth is, well, there's another ending. I don't know if you know it, right? Anyway, but the point is, yes, in Judaism, we can dance in two places at once. How can that be? And I tried to think of an example from our world today that would make that a little bit more tangible. How can we do something like that? And I thought about every Friday, I make sure that my earphones, my Bluetooth is recharged, because Friday is the day when it's full of phone calls from my kids. During the week, it's sporadic. But Friday, most of them, hopefully, will call to say Good Shabbos, and it's a very busy day. I want to speak to them, and yet, I have to move around a lot. So what do? First of all, I charge the Bluetooth. And the second thing is usually my phone, after it's been off the recharger for a while, it dies. So what I do is I make sure the Bluetooth is, because I only have one charger down here, Bluetooth has to be recharged, but my phone is sitting in the recharger all the time. So I can move around the kitchen and I can talk, but my phone is constantly being recharged. And I thought to myself, that might be one of the closest examples in our world. Yes, it has certain flaws if you want to start taking it apart, but closest example of how we can be spiritually, we can be in two places at once. We can actually have our soul stay with our Father, the King, and we can have our soul still do the work that it needs to do. I can be speaking on the phone, using the battery power from my phone, right? But my phone is still being recharged constantly. And that's what the King says. Don't worry, leave your soul with me. You go and do the work, but leave your soul with me.
Don't we do that? Sorry to interrupt, but don't we do that every week? Meaning, this Yeshua has speaking from the only person that this sure has a very large influence on my life, and about what has I've been taught here stays with me. So is my soul is somehow it's still here because I'm thinking about what I've learned, and yet I'm out and about doing what my life, and I'm affected by what I learned here, so my soul is here and I'm there.
Exactly, and that's part of what we're going to be. That is exactly the point we're getting to, actually. In the year 1772, the Maggid of Mezerich, the second big leader in the Hasidic movement, the student of the Baal Shem Tov, it was just before the 19th of Kislev on Shabbos. It was this portion of the Torah, Parshas Vayishlach, and he was about to pass away. He was speaking to his students, and in a great Hasidic discourse, which actually re-energized him, even though he was sick, he said these words. He expounded on the words Malachim Mamash, that Jacob sent the angels, the actual angels, and he said it a little bit differently than I explained it before. Malachim Mamash, he said, he sent the Mamash of the angels. He sent the tangible part of the angels, but the soul he left with him. Meaning, when he dispatched them, he sent to Esav. Esav actually saw people in front of him. But the soul stayed with Jacob. Because the soul was attached to the recharger all the time, the soul will not be hurt. And that, the Rebbe explained 200 years later, the Rebbe expounded on it in a much deeper way. I cannot do it justice. But the Rebbe was saying that we are sent here on a job of cosmic proportion. We are sent, our soul, our mission here in this world is to elevate the sparks down here in this world. We actually go down into the world of Esav. There's a lot when there's, we're going to talk about Esav a little bit in comparison to Yaakov. What does it mean? The Esav job and the Yaakov job. But the Esav, is the barrels of the world. But there's a lot of good to accomplish there in the barrels of the world. In the bowels of the world. There's, like I've said many times, I'm not one of these Kabbalists, but basically that when the world was created, it was first a world of tohu, of
chaos.
But within that chaos, there's a lot of good sparks to elevate. And our job, our mission here in this world is to go and to elevate those sparks. And so the angel, the person, is actually, he's commissioned to go down into this world, and he has a soul. He has to take part of his soul with him, but he has to leave the soul recharging, constantly recharging with God. He takes his mind, he takes his heart, he takes his body, and even his soul. His soul can actually be in two places at once. It's like, you can be here, and you can be doing what you have to do, but your soul can still be in Israel. Right? There's a way to split yourself into in that context.
Okay,
And so, we're talking about our souls. Okay, what does it mean, the soul of an angel? What does it mean, the energy, the lifeline of the angel? That's what it means. Is that they went to do their mission, but their lifeline was still attached. Their battery was still attached. Commissioned from God and still always attached. And that is what the Torah is always, it's not just on the superficial level, Esav, Yaakov, you know, the Jews. There's so many different levels. And what the Rebbe was explaining, that our mission here in this world, we are dispatched by our Father the King to go into the world, to that far-flung corner where things need to be fixed up, things need to be elevated. God desired that we should come into this world and find all those sparks and elevate them until the ultimate time of Mashiach, when it will all be elevated. And so, but the in order to accomplish that mission, we have to make sure that we're still in the recharger. We can walk around with the Bluetooth, and we could still be speaking. And so our soul is doing, because you could say, well, what does that mean? How could you say, if he's sending, why is he sending malachim? Why is he sending angels? He needs the highest power to accomplish a job. On this simple level and on the deeper level, right? We're going into a world, we have a hard job. You'd say, take the best forces you have with you, right? But the thing is that, yes, you take the best forces that you have with you, but you have to leave it recharging. And we're going to talk soon when we talk about the three-pronged plan. And Shalom actually alluded to it when he's speaking about Shabbos and how you can recharge your battery and continue and take your soul into the week. It's that idea. We go into this world, we have a mission to accomplish, but we have to make sure that we're constantly reattached. For us, for Chabad Shluchim, we have a different way of sort of picturing this in our own microcosm. Because we go out here, we come from a very different world. We live in a world that was saturated with Jewishness, with holiness, when we were around the Rebbe, and it's very nice, he could inspire us. When you're living there, it's so inspirational, and you're close to the closest source of holiness that you have here in this world. And so it's much easier to do your job and to be on a lofty level and to learn Torah and to feel elevated and you're doing the right things. But then the Rebbe sent us to places like White Rock or places like Malmo, Sweden, who is now struggling to keep their shul open and to be safe, or places like Mumbai and wherever it is. So how do shluchim, and I'm not talking about just physical safety, I'm talking about spiritual safety. So actually, maybe I shouldn't have used those examples. Let's say LA, and let's say Las Vegas, and let's say some of the other places, and you have to raise your children in places like that, and it is really a challenge. How do you do that? The only way, in Yiddish we have an expression, halten sich beim Klamke. Explain that.
Literally it means to hold on to the door handle.
Right, which is
the
only
door
way,
handle of the Rebbe's room, actually, is what it means.
Which means that, and by the way, this parsha was often the week of the kinnis, right? Or it's the week after the kinnis, but they often spoke
after,
about
right,
that.
Yeah.
That in our world, the Rebbe sent shluchim, but we had to make sure, if you want to be a shliach that is successful, the only way to manage is if you keep your soul with your mishalech, with the one who sent you. If you make sure that you're constantly recharging there, that even though you're doing your work here, your head is there and you're constantly recharging. And what, like I said, when we talk about the three-pronged plan, we'll talk about how does one recharge. But the important thing to remember here, when it says that Yaakov sent malachim mamash, he sent actual angels, and the Hasidic interpretation is he sent the actual part of the angels. They saw physical people walking there doing their mission. But it's important to remember that part of the soul is always has to be recharging. It has to be connected to its source in order for it to accomplish what it needs to here in this world. That's what we have to do with our job every day as we're trying to elevate the sparks in this world which has the resemblance of Esav, but we have to make sure that we are constantly connected and recharging.
So just with my wife's permission, I just want to use a personal example, because as I'm listening to this, I hope you don't mind me using this particular example. But you know, our children, they were raised in this home, and they're children. But there's no other children in this area like them. Now, how come they still, while they're here...
I said,
while they're here.
Careful.
I was careful. Yes, I said, while they're here. See, that's... you know, once they fly the coop, it's something else. But once they're here, they're not yearning to go and join the kids in public school or in the park or whatever. Or even if they're going, for example, to a school, I'll say it that way for the recording, where there are many other children. They have different standards. So how does that happen? If you were to pause them at any time during the 24 hours during their childhood and ask them, they would say, we're here on a mission. So even though they can't, at that age, they could not philosophize and explain, they knew that they were plugged in, basically, even though they didn't know this expression, to the door handle of the Rebbe's room. Really, that's what it was. They knew that, and that's how they were raised. Now, the reason that I'm saying this is not to speak about our family. Rather, it's to speak about ourselves, because we just heard about our soul coming from our Father in heaven. We're being dispatched. And you were speaking about the prayer in the morning, about that is in God's image, and you're absolutely correct. So now, let's ask ourselves this question, and I'll leave the question, because it's a hang inside our heads. If we were woken up at any time during the 24 hours, and somebody were to ask us, so what are you doing here in this world that's so full of, however you want to finish the sentence, would we say, as quickly as our kids at age 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, etc., would we say, we're plugged in, but we're here on a mission on this planet Earth. Okay, back to you, Sima.
Rita.
Yes, go ahead.
That's the issue.
Rita was just asking about elevating the sparks and how you find them. Well, wherever you go, you try to elevate them. And most likely, if you're in a place where we're told that if you end up somewhere, there's a reason for it. What's the reason? The reason is so that you find the sparks in that area and elevate it. And I think I've mentioned this before. Sometimes I've ended up in some interesting place, sometimes by mistake and sometimes on purpose. Like mistake would be taking a detour that you hadn't planned. So then you have to think to yourself, okay, I'm here for a reason. Sometimes the reason is obvious. How can I help someone here in this area? And if not, like when I used to take the kids and we somehow turned the wrong corner, I would say, okay, we're here, let's say some words of Torah. Possibly no one was ever in this corner of the world to say some words of Torah. And especially I find when we go on a vacation somewhere, you go somewhere where most people don't visit. I say, you never know. I davened Mincha in some beautiful place in the Rockies that I said, it could be since the beginning of the world, since that time of Tohu. No one has ever been here to elevate the sparks that are sitting here dormant. And God is waiting for someone to do that. So our life mission is that wherever we go to find sparks to elevate. We don't necessarily, sometimes we are so adept at finding sparks, we see it right in front of our face, and sometimes not. And we have to just make it our mission to be constantly elevating. And okay, I use the example of prayer, but for some people, maybe prayer doesn't speak to them as much. So it might be charity, it might be calling someone from that. Today, it's so easy to pick up a phone and calling a friend and saying a few good words because they're lonely, or finding you meet another Jew on the top of a mountain and you speak to them and something that will inspire them Jewishly. So we just have to make it our mission. We don't necessarily know, oh, are there 5 sparks here? 6 sparks? You know, we just do that in our life. We go around and we make it our mission to elevate the sparks.
Okay, let me just explain something. First of all, a shameless plug for the Kabbalah class. One of the subjects that we're going to, in one of these weeks, be dealing with in depth is exactly this subject of Tohu and Tikkun, which loosely would translate as chaos and reparation. Let's say it as follows. Let's say there's what's the name of those falls in Canada, United States?
Niagara.
The Niagara Falls, right? So what stands in the way of those however many thousands, millions, I don't know, tons of water comes crashing down? So that would be the chaos. So like a tsunami is a chaos. Or there's a place that has tremendous wind. So you say, well, that chaos is just it's all destructive. But the truth of the matter is that there's something very powerful there. And if you can harness some of that power in the Niagara Falls, then you get to provide electricity, I believe it is, for two states in the United States side, or something like that, right? So that is and the same thing with wind. Well, here's a place where there's a tremendous amount of wind, and who can even live there? So you brace yourself and you make a wind farm, I think is what they call it, with all those fans. And those fans, as the wind is just crushing, is just pushing through, again, it generates electricity. And I think, so obviously we'll get more in depth in the Kabbalah class when we get there. So now, in the Hayom Yom, on this very point, it says, and I believe that this Hayom Yom ends up being one of the days of the Kinos, either most years or every year. And it says something like this, that divine providence leads a person's Me'ashem mitzadei korig kenono, that God leads the footsteps of man. That's a biblical verse. That God, the divine providence, leads a person to the place where he can elevate those sparks that have been waiting from the beginning of time. They haven't changed. They're still there waiting. So let's say another way of looking at this. One of the elements of Jewish history of modern times, meaning since the First World War, actually. That's what I suppose it began, unless an historian wants to disagree with me. One of the stories of the Jewish people of the world is about moving communities. For example, after the First World War, Jews who lived in the rural areas, they became urbanized. But today we have areas that are moving, so people move to Vancouver, and they live, let's say, Shaughnessy. Okay, there's only a certain amount of time that people can afford to live in Shaughnessy. So they find somewhere else to move, and they move somewhere else. And if you go to anywhere, in London, so Stamford Hill, Golders Green, Hendon, there's moving communities. So one of the things that's very interesting, that you had certain communities that were Jewish for a very long time, and then there's no Jews there anymore. One place is Harlem. And believe it or not, I mean, Harlem used to be a place that if you had white skin, and you walked there, and you would walk through it, you would have to thank the Almighty if you came out alive at the other end. And that's not an exaggeration. Today, Harlem is becoming an up-and-coming area, which is shocking. But it used to be a Jewish community to the extent that we recently discovered that during the times, I think it was mentioned there, during the times of the Third Rebbe, an ancestor, either a great uncle or something like that of Simi's, was actually a rabbi in one of the many shuls in Harlem. How come there's no Jews there now? Because the sparks were elevated. There used to be a tremendous amount of Jewishness.
Well, now there's
some. So there's some. Okay, so you still have to, no. Some left, but it's never back to its former glory.
Yuppie, yeah.
Right. Some yuppie Jews will move there, fine. But yeah, but how, is it gonna have as many shuls as it used to then? And if you can go back to different areas of the world, Spain, what they call the Golden Age of Spain, there are Jews in Spain now, some. And how many Jews are back there? Now, you can say, well, we were thrown out of Spain. Guess what? We were thrown out of England, and the Jews came back during the times of Oliver Cromwell, because there were still sparks to elevate. There's very few Jews in Spain, because there's very few sparks left to elevate. So divine providence brings us to a place that the fact that we are there, wherever there is an indicator that from this world of chaos, Olam HaToyu, which, as I said, we'll explain it more in the Kabbalah class, that some of that energy is divine energy, divine sparks, is waiting for you or me, whoever happens to be there, to elevate it. Yes. So the word sparks, how do you wrap your head around the word sparks? It's very hard to describe a concept that is purely divine and beyond time and space when we need to speak a language that deals with time and space. So if we say, I'll use the word, although I don't like it word for a certain reason, I'll use the word potential divine energy, or let's maybe the word a latent godly energy, meaning that the energy is there, is just waiting to be harnessed. So, take for example, an easy example would be technology. There's tremendous divine energy within the electrons of the world. And we use them for electricity, and through electricity, we can do all the good things that we do. So that latent divine energy, meaning say the energy that's there, that's waiting for a Jewish person to harness it towards God's purpose, we call a spark. Why do we call it a spark? Because a spark, even at the stage of being a spark, creates the imagery of light. Light is the word we use for a whole host of reasons, that it's the best word available when referring to divine energy. So spark refers to something that can cause something to completely ignite, and we understand that within the spark is something very powerful. It just starts, and it's the start of something big. So we need to get used to, when we use anthropomorphisms, this actually was a subject in last week's Kabbalah class. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. To get used to thinking these words as analogies, not as depictions. So that's why we say the word sparks, but what we mean is a latent divine energy that can be accessed by us. Right?
Us being people or us being Jews.
Okay, so here is the thing. Us being people, us being Jews, I just want to repeat that for the recording because that's a very important question. And I would like to answer it very concisely because it's an entire subject. There are two parts to harnessing this world to God's purpose. One is what you stay away from. And the other is what you initiate. Now, to initiate something that is divine beyond this world can only happen by someone who's within the world. I mean, how could you do something beyond this world if you're within this world? That can only happen through someone who was given energy that is beyond this world. Now, 1 second. So, different people have different levels of energy because as far as staying away from evil, we can all do that. Doesn't matter, Jewish, non-Jewish, a Kohen or a Levi or a Yisrael, and I'm mentioning those categories for a reason. But take, for example, the ability to initiate the harnessing of divine energy, let's say in a sacrifice in the temple, outside of certain parts that belong to the tribe of Levi, that divine ability was only given or is only embedded within the soul of a Kohen. So in other words, if I, let's say, went into the temple and brought up a sacrifice, did everything right, I wouldn't have done it because spiritually I don't have that energy. So the peoples of the world who are not commanded with the Jewish commandments, rather they have 7 areas of commandments. It's primarily to cultivate this world to be fertile for those who are given the ability to initiate, to take this world and elevate it beyond what this world is. meaning the Jewish people. So in other words, someone invented how to create the right kind of roads. Now, whatever they were thinking, I need to feed my family, so I studied how to do this, I came up with an idea, and now we have this kind of roads and whatever they, however it works. So that's what they were thinking. But within God's plan, they were doing something that's a million times greater than that. First of all, the roads allowed people to be rushed by ambulance to hospital. I mean, just think about whether you can even think, and in the whether a human mind can even internalize how gargantuan that is, how many lives have been saved because you sat at your desk and the drawing board and you invented how to make a straight road. That's on one hand. But then if you take it a step further, that road allows somebody, for example, to live here where we are and do what we're doing now, which is teaching Torah, even though their child goes to school 30 miles away. So that is where we're elevating something within this world to be higher than the world. So coming back to elevating the sparks, on the one hand, we say that every single person, every single thing has a purpose. But on the other hand, we say that purpose has a hierarchy. So just like a Yisroel is not going to do what a Levi does, and a Levi is not going to do what a Kohen does, so a non-Jewish person is not going to do what a Jew does, but they are part of God's purpose. When we talk about elevating the sparks, we're talking about harnessing a divine energy that is beyond the world. And that can only be accomplished by those who have been given the commandment by God, because that means that they have been injected with a supernatural ability to do so. That's the concise answer.
Is that why so many sparks are flying in Israel? Well, it's too much for that.
It's really, yeah, there's
Israel,
a...
You have all these Jews who are creating all these, like, unbelievable things.
Correct, 100%.
Arabs trying to put the sparks out.
Yeah.
Right. Just that story that I told for those who joined us on Thursday night about Rechnitz, who is a philanthropist, and met 400 soldiers in an airport.
In Ireland.
In Ireland, and decided that, you know what, I'm going to do something that will be elevating the sparks, because people will say, wow, those Jews, and a great thing that he did, he felt that these soldiers shouldn't just have army-grade food. And he went and he paid $50 for each soldier, which works out to...
400 times 50. Okay, who's got good at math?
20,000.
American
to have a nice dining,
you
got to
add 30%.
To have a nice dining experience. And he decided that within a minute. So somewhere in Ireland, there were sparks that had to be elevated. And he was there and he just caught the moment and he did it. Right? So, yeah. Anyway, but let's just, if you don't mind, let's go back to the Parsha a little, although this was all part of the Parsha. But because we said we'll move on to the three-pronged plan, and I will try to connect it with some of what we just spoke about.
Can I just interrupt one last thing? I'm sorry. I'm sorry, just because this is such so relevant. I just gave an example of whoever invented the way we make roads, right? And what the product is so much bigger, I don't think the human mind could contain it. So the truth of the matter is, what we are being taught in the teachings of Hasidut, really, is that any time you or me, and I'm saying you or me because I want to sort of poke my finger in your chest the way teachers used to do when I was a kid, so to speak, is to say that any time you or I elevate any sparks, it is similarly so much bigger, as in the example of the fellow who invented the roads. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So Sherlock Holmes and Watson went camping. And they put up their tent, and they're enjoying the beautiful camping experience. During the night, Sherlock wakes Watson up, and he says to him, "Watson, what do you see?" And Watson starts waxing eloquent. "I see the celestial beings. I see the double-decker. I see the magnificence of the sky, the enormity, the amazing, amazing world that we have above us." And then he says, to Sherlock, and what do you see, my friend? And Sherlock said, somebody stole our tent! Thank you for those who laughed, even though you heard it from me before. So, Yaakov and Esav. Let's talk about this three-prong plan and what it was about. Our sages tell us, and those of you who have looked through the parsha before, Yaakov is going after 34 years. He's coming back home, and he's about to meet his brother who hates him, who envies, who was angry at him because of the blessings and all the stories that we've already spoken about. And he's about to meet his brother, and he prepares in three ways. He prepares, first of all, he prepares gifts to send to his brother. And he all sorts of sheep, flock, all sorts of animals, and he sends them, he divides them. He sends them in a way that it should look really big for his brother. Not just one swoop, he sends them group and group and group, more and more and more. So he sends him a huge, magnanimous gift. And then he does something else. He prays. He prays to God. He prays that it should all work. And he makes a deal with God and what he will do. And he asks God to protect him. And the third thing is that he prepares for war. That just in case none of that's going to work, I better be ready. I have to prepare for war. We have to be practical. Which, by the way, I'm not going to go off on a tangent, but many of you can just relate it to what's going on here in the world. Very nice to say, let's all be nice and let's be, if we just do goodness and kindness, which we should, and which is what our mission is, and especially those who are not out at the battlefront fighting, we do have to increase in goodness and kindness, but you also have to be practical, and that's what Yaakov did. He prepared his camp for war. He protected, you know, anyway, I can really get lost on that tangent, and I know my husband really can. He had a three-prong approach. We know that the stories of the Torah, as we've said before, and we've said many times, it's not just on the simple level of what we see. This happened, yes, it happened in actuality, but it's also to go onto a deeper level. And we know that Yaakov and Esav embody two different forces that there are here in our own lives, in our own personal lives. Not just that there are Yaakovs in the world and there are Esavs in the world, but within each of us, there is a Yaakov force and an Esav force. There is the ego, there is the part of us that wants, that lusts, that desires, that's animalistic. And then there is the spiritual side of things, the lofty side of things, the one that dwells in tents, or the one we say Yaakov is Hakol, Kol Yaakov, the voice of Yaakov, the much loftier part of us. And we also have the Esav part of us, the physical, the Adayim Midei Esav, the physical, animalistic, very, very worldly force within us. So the spiritual and the idealistic is really how we could term it. What happens? As we know, Yaakov and Esav, there was a fight. There was a constant sparring between the two of them. There was something always, the two of them were at war. What does that mean within us? We have these two forces. And unless someone's a great tzaddik, most of us, I would say probably all of us, except for those great, great holy men who have nothing fighting inside of them, very hard to find, have those two different forces, the rivalry within us. We have the struggle between our ego and our humbleness, between our selfish cravings and our noble aspirations. And the question is, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with that rivalry that we have to face constantly within us? And how do we make sure that we, of course, strive to go towards the loftier part of ourselves and become the best of ourselves? So we have to confront the Esav within us every single day. And in order to confront the Esav within us, the egocentric part of us, the lustful part of us, all of that, we have to have a plan. And the first thing is, we have to feed our animal, right? We have to feed it physically. We have to feed it. We have to give it certain things that we need. We have to food, right? And we need to have sleep, and we need to have air. We're not, Torah does not value asceticism. Yes. Yeah. We do not promote fasting, rolling on the ground, and doing that type of thing, and punishing oneself in order not to take care of our animal side. It doesn't work that way. So the first thing is, we have to take care of our basic needs. God gave us a body, and it is our job to feed that body, to clothe the body. It's not ours. It's God's. He gave it to us for safekeeping. It's not for us to decide to hurt it or not to hurt it. We have to take care of it. It's a precious gift. He gave it to us. That part we take care of. So we acknowledge that we have those gifts, and we don't have to feed it lavishly, and we don't have to get overly indulgent, but we have to take care of it. And of course, we speak about this Shabbos, how we, in order to have our soul really, really enjoy the lofty part of Shabbos, we actually sit at a table and we eat beautiful meals and we dress in our finery. It's all very nice, but through it, we work through it to elevate and to get to our Yaakov side of us. But then there is the next part of the plan, and that's prayer. Yaakov said to God, he says, Hatzileni na, rescue me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. He's praying, God, I need you in partnership. I'll take care of this body that you gave me. And I will take care of the animal needs that I have, but help me to take, help me when my brother Esav is coming against me. Why is there the redundancy? My brother Esav. Because yes, it is partner with us. It's part of us. God put us, we can't, it's like a person can't say, you know, certain things we can say, okay, I swear off of this, and then we don't have that craving. Like, for example, a person can live without smoking, but he can't live without air. He needs to have air, right? So that's the part of us, that's the part that's his brother. A person needs to have a certain amount of self-esteem. Doesn't mean he has to have ego. A person has to have food. That's actually where the tricky part is, because it's part of us, but yet we don't want to become indulgent. So it's our brother. It's part of us. You can't get rid of it. It is within us. You can't say, well, I won't feed my animal. Yes, I do have to feed my animal, but that's where prayer comes in. Because if a person connects to God on a daily basis, especially if he starts off his day with prayer, even if he can't do all his prayers in the morning, but he starts off acknowledging, God, you are in charge. You are the one who directs everything. So that this way, when he goes into business every day, and he might have these animalistic urges to go and take more and to get more, to possibly do certain things in business that are shaky. If he connected with God on a daily basis, hopefully, we have to work on ourselves. It's not automatic. We have to work on ourselves. And the more we pray and remind ourselves that God's in charge. And I want to stick in it. For some people, it's not just prayer that works. It's actually study. You can't say, I will become, I was just listening yesterday to Dennis Prager. Can't say, I will just become this holy person without actually studying it. It's not automatic for many people to know the right thing to do. You have to actually learn the right thing to do. He gave an example for a person goes into a camera shop and he goes and he asks the clerk all sorts of information about this camera, knowing that he's really going to buy it online. He says, if you learn the Torah, you will have learned that that is wrong. You're not allowed to do things like that. That is stealing from that company, because you're using that person's time. And he gives another example, which I've heard him give many times, is he says, this question has actually come up to him on his show. I don't know if the question came up, or if he presented the question. He says, what if you were out swimming in the ocean with your dog, right? And you see there's, well, you can say it, your mother-in-law, or you can just say it, a random person that you don't know, okay? And your dog are drowning. Which one, God forbid, I would never say it about my mother-in-law. I love her, she's a wonderful person, but you know the joke, right? Okay, let's say random person and dog drowning, right? And you love your dog, you don't know the random person. Which would you save? And he has presented that on his show many times. And he says, well, people call up, well, Dennis, you know, I love my dog. I don't know this person. That person's not part of me. You know, and it becomes a whole discussion of which one is really right. Well, who says the dog is not more valuable? So he says, that's where Torah actually being your lifeline tells you, no, it's not. There is a rule book. You know what? Your dog is lovely and wonderful and helpful. And he says about himself, he says, I love my dog more than you. He says that, but I would still save you. He says, you're safe swimming around me. I would still save you. Why? Because man is created in God's image, and the dog is not. Okay? And we have to weigh what we do each day with a scale, not our own scale. He gives some very good examples, and we can talk about it another time. But the point is that prayer and Torah learning and recharging ourselves, which is what I was talking about before, making sure our charger is plugged in and our soul is connected, keeps us in line so that when the Esav part of us is pulling at us, we have the Yaakov part of us rejuvenating and constantly recharging and knowing what the right thing is to do and keeping us in line so that we side with Yaakov and not with Esav. And then I'll just finish, and I'm doing it in brief, because I still want my husband to do some of today's class, although he did. The third part is all-out war. There are certain times where there are certain lusts or certain cravings that we have that are no-nos. And we could try, and the prayer is not helping us, and Torah learning is not helping us. It's not. It didn't go penetrate in our head, didn't penetrate in our heart. You know what? You still do what you gotta do. And you go all out and you punch it in the face. That's war. When you say, no, this is not for me. This I do not do. I am a Yaakov person. I am not an Esav person. Actually, he gave this example. He didn't talk about the parsha, but I'm just thinking of an example he gave. Someone called his show and he says, Dennis, I'm a terrible person. So he says, well, what's the matter? He says, my mother is living with us. She hasn't been able to live on her own for a long time. She's been living with us, and we've been taking care of her because she can't be on her own. And I confess, Dennis, that sometimes I feel that maybe I wish she would succumb to whatever illness she has because I can't handle it anymore. And I'm a terrible person. So he says, I love you. You are such a good person. And he says, Dennis, don't make fun of me. You know, like, don't make me feel worse than I already feel. He says, no, I really mean it. I'm not making fun of you. He says, what are you talking about? He says, I love you because you are doing the right thing. You might be feeling a certain way. I don't care what you feel. The point is that you're doing the right thing. And that's what I say, punch it in the face. Is that there are certain things that come up and we have certain cravings. I'm talking here on a man-to-man basis, but we should also apply it on a man-to-God basis. Because there are mitzvahs in the Torah. We know people here are all learned. We have 613 of them. Some are between man and man. Some are between man and God. And so it's easier for us to understand this on a man-to-man basis. But it's also on a man-to-God basis. Okay? I'm being very blunt. Shabbos, Yantif, this is hard, this is hard. No, this I don't want to do, this I do want to do. That's why we need to keep ourselves in line. Prayer, Torah study, and if all else fails, punch it in the face. Go out all war and say, you know what? This is not for me. I'm a Jewish soul. I'm recharging there. Somehow maybe my recharger is a little shaky because on the way I've gotten a little diverted. But I am saying, no, this is not for me, even if I don't feel like it. So that's the three-prong thing. You have those, there are times when we see our tent, and there are times when we see our stars. There's times that are very lofty, and there's times that we're grounded in the tent. We have to make sure to always let our Yaakov side win. I think I'm going to stop with that.
Just to answer some questions here, being at war with yourself. So, I'll tell you how I would put it into words for myself. Because what does it mean to go to war with myself? Well, who am I? Let's just say, for example, a soldier, let's say from this country, has been captured in a war, and they're trying to torture information out of them. So that soldier keeps his mouth closed. They actually have training about how to keep your mouth closed under torture, which is a terrible thing. And the way is, if you remember who you are, you can be in wherever, I won't choose another country, take your pick, and if this is who I am, then I'm going to be strong. The truth of the matter is, and this is explained in other places in Chassidut, that in order for a person to sin, they actually have to temporarily or momentarily assume that they are someone else. Meaning to say, let's just go back to the beginning, that I am on a mission from God, right? I'm plugged into, up there, to my Father in heaven. Well, then, there's just no way I'm succumbing to whatever it is, to X, right? And that stance, like a Marine or a SEAL, take your pick, the best Israeli soldiers, right? That inner stance, that's the stance of war, that there's just no way. All right. So that's to address what you said. Yes? Have I got that?
Yes.
Okay, now, to address what
Binyamin
said, the truth of the matter is, to answer it fully means to go back to previous parashas and make this into a whole different class, like what happened, how come, so on and so forth. So I'll answer you in a very short way. Since when does any wrong other than somebody trying to kill you give anyone permission to kill someone else? So no matter how a person would like to interpret what led up to the friction between Yaakov and Esav, none of it warrants killing them. And just it's like saying, the Arab accomplices in the press, I'll say it straight out, right? And for example, will point out to so on and such things, which somehow justifies going into a home and mowing everybody down or other such things. It doesn't. There's nothing in the world that justifies sending Jews to the gas chamber. There's nothing in the world that justifies killing somebody if they're not out to kill you. Nothing. Now, so that is the short version to answer the question in relationship to here.
But there's more.
Of course there's more.
About the Jewish guilt. I just want to mention one point that you left out there, is that Esav should have clarified, if you want, on a very simple level, he should have clarified to his father that he sold the birthright, and that the birthright belongs rightfully to Yaakov, so that Yaakov deserved the blessing to begin with. Why it happens to be that Rivka, who could have said it straight to her husband, like all Jewish women do, they just straighten their husbands out. She could have said it, right? But she chose not to.
Because
she knew that Yaakov is supposed to get the blessing. So she was going to make sure it happened. But she wanted it to happen as he was dressed up in Esav's clothing. Because she knew that the day will come that there will be Yaakovs walking around this world that are dressed like Esav. And they still need the blessing. And therefore she allowed it to happen this way instead of clarifying her husband's eyes and saying to him, look here, you're blessing the wrong one. You think that it's Esav that's supposed to get it. On a very simple level, it's not his because he sold the birthright. And because you think that you're going to energize Esav because he has these sparks dormant in him, and therefore you figure that you're going to help him pick himself up, well, it's not going to work. And Yaakov is the one that needs the blessings, and we've discussed this in depth at other times. But it wasn't, it is not this Jewish guilt thing. Yaakov did deserve the blessings, it was his, it's just that Rivka chose to make it happen by dressing Yaakov in Esav's clothing instead of telling him the blessing rightfully goes to Yaakov.
Right.
I think that's all we need to say right now about it.
Let's
right.
Right. I just want to say, see, we could go into this, which really means going into the whole other parasha, last week's parasha. I do want to say this. When Yaakov said, the voice is the voice of Yaakov and the hands are the hands of Esav, what is he telling you? When Yitzchak said it to Yaakov, what is he saying? Oh, I'm so sure that you are Esav. Is that why he said it? No, it's because, and if you listen to last week's recording, you'll hear we mentioned some of that. It's because he's getting a sense that, you know what, I had a plan, and it seems like that God's plan is a little bit of a different one, and that's going to win out.
And more, right? I'm sorry, I just want to add a little bit to that, and I'm not sure if you mentioned it last week, but Yitzchak was looking to elevate those sparks in Esav, but when he saw that Esav was dressed in, Yaakov was dressed in Esav's clothing, and he said, the voice is the voice of Yaakov, and the hands are the hands of Esav. He's saying, finally, I see this combination coming together the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be the Yaakov, the voice of Yaakov. And there are times when we have to use the hands of Esav together. Unfortunately, today, that seems to be part of the plan, part of the divine plan. But he knew it. And even if you want to go into the actual nitty-gritty about the way Yaakov answered his father, you can go through the nitty-gritty and it will show you that it's not really a lie the way he said it. The way he answered, he just said, Ani. It's I, right? But the point is much, much deeper, is that Rivka, who knew that the blessings belonged to Yaakov, made sure that Yaakov would get them because she knew that the Jewish people are the ones that are supposed to get that blessing.
Right.
Anyway, I think we should continue on to Genesis.
Yeah. Do you want to take that one?
No.
Whatever. Yeah.
Say one thing, just to round up the class before you answer Genesis' question, which is very relevant, is that I think let's just summarize and remember we're talking about the Torah on different levels in our own microcosm and then us as a nation, and even as a nation, we have different levels that we're dealing with it, and we're dealing with the inner struggle within ourselves of the Yaakov part of us and the Esav part of us. For that, there is the three-prong solution of feeding our animal, prayer throughout all of it, so that we make sure that we are in the right direction, and if certain things that we're fighting with, we are not helped by prayer or by Torah study and by making sure that we're in our charger, then all out war, meaning we say, we make a battle against that animalistic part of us that's fighting, and we say, no, this is an absolute no. So that's within our own microcosm, within our own selves even, and then there's the microcosm around us, and then the larger, the macrocosm, our world as Jews and as part of the secular world, is that even for that one, there's the three-prong solution, but the three-prong has to all happen at the same time. So we are, even while we are preparing a gift, and we are appeasing, so to speak, and we're trying to create the best solution to make everybody happy, we have to remember that God's in charge, and therefore we have to go make sure that any gifts we give and anything that we do is in line with what God wants. One thing for sure we know is that God gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. There's no question about it. There's no discussion about it. So it's not ours to give. It's God's. And so appeasement meaning we are, Jewish people are not out to go and do battle with anybody. We're happy to live with everybody side by side. We're not going out there to conquer anyone's lands. We're not going out there to God forbid, acts of terror to anybody else. We are just ready to live side by side. But we have to remember, God's in charge. We pray to Him. We study Torah and make sure that we're in line with what God wants. And the third thing, and of course nobody wants this, is war, when we have to, in order to protect whatever it is, to protect ourselves, it's called self-preservation, that is all-out war. That's a very simplified way of saying this three-pronged solution.
Okay. I'd like to say something also along these lines. But I maybe this is just me and the study of history, but the word appeasement it gets on my nerves, even though by the dictionary definition it could be used.
I actually had a different word.
But I don't want to. So I'm going to use an example that happened recently, and it does involve another person, because we could also be speaking with ourselves. Simi was speaking about before food, a person who. Okay, I'll just stick this in very quickly. If you're on a serious diet and you need to have a cheat day, make sure the cheating day is Shabbos. Because on Shabbos, all pleasurable foods and all those pleasures, they're all elevated. So I just wanted to stick that in. But coming back to what you're saying, here's an incident that happened recently, which began many years ago. And I'm saying this, and it's being recorded, because this relates to certain other individuals in our community. There's a certain fellow who drives an expensive car, retired, white hair, and he comes around unannounced and just wants to schmooze, and he's a real schmoozer. And sometimes he'll drop off the different expensive coffee table books, you know, maybe Jerusalem Post of the last 50 years. In his mind. And he, you know, tries to make small talk, and if I was somebody else, I'd say, hey, listen, you're wasting my time. Could you please, all right? So, I know that the way I'm dressed, even before I open my mouth, I represent something whether I'm in the mood or not. So I can't just tell him in so many French words to bug off, okay? Because I get nothing, and I do have an idea of where he's coming from, as you shall soon hear.
He's always putting in Christian ideas.
Yes, and he's always slipping that in, and he's little, but he tells me that, oh yes, and I spoke with this one, a member of our community that you all know, and another one, a member of the community that you all know.
Is he Jewish or not?
He's not Jewish. So anyway, it came that the time before last that he came, because the last time he came was, I think, 3 days ago, if I'm not mistaken. So that was last week he came, and I got really irritated by something. But step one is I'm being nice to him. Step one that we were speaking about. So I won't use the word appeasement. I don't need to appease him at all in that sense, but I'm doing the nice thing. I'm gifting him with my time, which for me is an utter waste of time. Okay, now, in my own head, as it often happens, I'm asking myself, am I dealing with this the right way? Because I know he has a Christian agenda. Otherwise, why in the world is he showing up? If he has that kind of a fancy car, let him do whatever, you know. He's not made it into nation, right? I mean, what are you coming up? Especially if you're coming with a collector's car, driving with a collector's car, you're making a statement. So give me, you know. So I'm saying to myself, what is the right thing? What's the right thing? What's the right thing? And it's been a few years, I have to tell you, with this guy. So that's the second element. So there's introspection. And I asked the Almighty, I should make the right decision. So anyway, two times ago, he comes by. And then towards the end, he says to me, he says, oh, and you know that they're having this thing where business people are coming together and, you know, they're sharing, it's a share day, and they, you know, they speak about how they found the Lord and how it changed their lives and all of that, so that other people can hear and see if they would like to do the same. He tells me this right here by the front door. So as that happened, so this is where you can use the word war, but I'm standing firm who I am, but I'm still using step one. And I basically, although I said, listen, I got to do some things. I can't, have a great day. He comes back a few days ago, but this time he's got this big fat book, you know, the type that costs, I don't know, maybe $100 is on the Holocaust. You know, served with plastic wrapped, you know, shrink wrapped and all of that. And he wants to give it. You know, like some of the other books that he's come in the past. And this had bothered me so much in my own head because I figured, you know, so that's what it's come to. So finally he thinks, so maybe I'll catch another fish. Maybe the rabbi will come and listen to, yeah, right. Yeah, he doesn't know who he's talking to. So I had already, in my head, I said, okay, what am I going to do if he comes back again? And I had already devised the battle plan, what Yaakov did here. So what I, so basically, I decided that when he comes to the door and starts telling me this and this, I said, listen, I need to tell you something. Nothing to do with what he said. He said, last time you came, you said this and this and this, and I want you to know that this is extremely offensive. And I, however I said it. So he starts saying such and such. Basically, before he left, I let him know that we Jews are very sensitive because we know about persecution. He starts speaking about Catholics. I said, you speak Catholics? Let me tell you about Martin Luther, about how he wrote, you should read what he wrote. Let's burn their synagogues, let's kill their rabbis and burn their books. I told him all that.
Even though Jews marched on Washington with him.
That's Martin Luther King. This is Martin Luther from the Protestant Reformation, right?
Yeah, okay.
So then, the original Martin Luther. Yeah. So, and I said to him, I know that people will come in and testify because of an emotional experience. Because if you have a lot of things that you've done wrong, for example, and you can say, I believe in this man 2,000 years ago, and let go of whatever you've done. And you can fill in some of the worst sins, which I won't say on the recording. So the Catholics, you do it through a confessional. And then with the Protestants, you just say that you believe in so-and-so. So it's all, of course you have people, if you could let go of being so unfaithful, etc., etc., by just believing that this is so on and so forth, then of course you feel a relief and your life changes. And I said, he says to me, because you know there can be no atonement without the blood sacrifice. I said, exactly. See, you're on the right track. I said to him, nowhere in the 24 books of the Tanakh does it say that there's no atonement without sacrifice. It says exactly the opposite. Just read Psalm 51. When Nathan the prophet comes to King David and tell him about the story with Bathsheba, and he says, if you would want a sacrifice, I would give it, but that's not what you want. But you'd rather want the utterance of my lips, and in Hosea, right? I'm telling straight to his face, and I tell him, in Judaism, not only do we have emotions, but we were given a mind, and we cannot accept that we say on the one hand we believe in one God, and then we say there's a trinity of three Godheads. That's a square circle. And there is no one in the church who can explain. I told him all these things. So what I'm saying, that's right. So what I'm giving you is a real example where in my life, on the one hand, I was nice to him for all these years. He comes around in Yiddish, we say, drehen a kop, just driving me bonkers. And just because I look a certain way and whatever, I don't know, should I, shouldn't I? And the introspective part, and hoping that God will guide me to do the right thing. But then when he starts telling about people testifying, so then I was a soldier. I didn't use my hands, but I sure used my mouth, right? So that, I think, is if we want to take it outside of only within ourselves, how we interact with other people, you know, that's how it is.
Okay, I think.